It's Tuesday, June 16th, 2009, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org. and continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Good day, Stashers, and welcome to the podcast. At the end of the podcast last night, I kind of left a teaser that there would be a special announcement on today's podcast, so here it is. Today is my 300th daily audio stash. Okay, I know, it's not earth-shattering news or anything. I just thought it was kind of an interesting milestone. Speaking of interesting, did you catch the Anderson Cooper show last night on CNN? I know a lot of us were tuned into it for America's High, the case for and against legalizing pot. And it was a great show in general. I liked especially that Anderson presented some factual information, like that there are 15 million of us out here that are using marijuana monthly. Might have mentioned that there are 22 million of us using annually, but whatever. That's great. Good to have some factual information out there. But as I kind of predicted, this also kind of turned out to be one of those fair and balanced sort of situations where the media says, you know, there's two sides to every story. So they got to present one side that's completely factual and common. And then they have to find some strange, rare case against it to present balance, which kind of leaves the audience thinking it's a 50-50 coin flip. I'm talking, of course, about Melissa Etheridge, who is a great spokesman on our side. I'm going to play a little bit of her in a second. And then following her was the experience of Lisa, or that's her pseudonym anyway, because she didn't want to be identified, this school teacher with bipolar disorder who supposedly almost died from her medical marijuana use. I just want to say that Lisa being a spokesperson against medical marijuana is kind of like a person allergic to bee stings being a spokesperson against honeybees. The presentation didn't make a whole lot of sense, and I got to think about how many times they tried to find somebody to speak against medical marijuana and how hard it must have been to find even Lisa. You know, Melissa's point, she represents so many people who have gotten benefit from medical marijuana, the hundreds of thousands, maybe even millions of people, if you count those who are self-medicating, who've gotten benefit from medical marijuana. And to try and find one strange case of someone with a pre-existing bipolar disorder who says that it worked for her until it stopped working for her and is now on lithium, to present that as the anti-case, I think, just made our case a whole lot stronger. Here's a particular clip from Melissa Etheridge in her conversation with Anderson Cooper. I thought she made a really good point in this as Anderson tried to lead her off on the aren't people just trying to get high angle.
Do you worry about abuse? I mean, certainly there are people who, you know, just want to get high, get a prescription, and then it makes it easier for them to buy marijuana.
Well, then again, there's people that want to take Percocet, you know, and they're looking for that. There's a Vicodin, you know, and this is a people issue. It's not the drug. It's the people. There are people who are in pain. And why are they in pain? Let's look at that. Let's put all this money, all these billions of dollars that we've been using to prohibit something because we've labeled that the bad thing. Why don't we put some research into the reason that these people are in pain, that they would do that to their body, that they would want to be out of pain, want to be numbed, and once, you know, they realize that, that pot isn't going to do that, then they're going to go to something else. You know, that's the problem in our country. That's, it's not the substance, it's the people and the way of life in our culture.
So you're saying just because the system might be abused by some people, it doesn't mean you check out the system.
Right, exactly. It's, let's follow why doesn't someone want to live a productive life? What is the pain in their life? What's out of balance? And then these people are withering away in jail. This doesn't make sense.
As I watched the end of that clip with Melissa Etheridge there, and she's mentioning a very salient point that it's not a problem with a substance, it's a problem with people. I can't help but think of that old saying we've got out west that guns don't kill people, people kill people. Or maybe people with guns kill people, I forget. Anyway, it was a great clip. I was glad to see Melissa Etheridge as a spokesperson, and I'm looking forward to the rest of the week. Remember, this Anderson Cooper 360 special, America's High, the Case for and Against Pot, is going to be on all the rest of this week, Tuesday through Friday, 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern Time on CNN. Now, coming up on today's Daily Audio Stash, we've got your hemp headlines, and speaking of guns, as I was earlier, I'm taking a look at that claim we hear echoed in the media and from politicians that 90% of the guns used in the drug war in Mexico come from the United States. Fox News and the NRA have a great disagreement with that statistic. I'm going to take a look at the facts and try to sort them out for you. Also, good news from my state in Oregon, where an attempt to limit the rights of medical marijuana patients to have jobs has died in the Oregon House. In our Government at Work segment today, returning back to our regular stash rotation, we're going to speak to Evan Nissen and Fred DeMaria from New Jersey Normal and the talk of a new initiative in East Brunswick for low priority. Then, in our Daily Toker Tunes, brought to you by Marijuana Music Awards, I continue to fill you in with some tunes from my collection, as Tam is busy with the American Marijuana Music Awards ceremony. A little bit of rap from my friends Los Marihuanos and their song Flame On. And then, at the end of the show, we're moving our California Marijuana Report to Tuesdays now on the Stash, making a slight schedule change. Eric Brenner brings you all the latest news from the Golden State. Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger says he wants a debate on legalizing marijuana. Well, Governor, I'm right here. Give me a call. It's time for your Normal Daily Audio Stash.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 13 states today, and THCF has clinics in 8 of those states. Our doctors help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms such as multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help you obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, California, Colorado, Hawaii, Nevada, Montana, and now Michigan. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our Normal Daily Audio Stash, Hemp Headlines. Headlines. 90% of guns in Mexican drug war come from the United States. Or not. Yesterday, I had written this in a post about Mexican officials seeking asylum in the United States. How tragic. We fund the Mexican cartels because we prohibit a plant that Americans demand, then we supply 90% of the firearms and ammunition to the cartels that they use to terrorize police. But when the police run to us in fear for their lives, we won't grant them asylum. Now, that post got me an email from a reader named Tom who said, "You stated that the U.S. supplies 90% of the firearms to the Mexican cartels. This is not true. The U.S. at the most supplies 33% and as little as 14% of the firearms used by the cartels. Russ, please retract this misstatement. Please do not muddy this movement for liberty with unevaluated quotes from anti-gun groups." And I thought, hold on, I'm usually really careful with the numbers. Did I unknowingly slip up? I don't recall gathering quotes from the Brady Campaign to End Gun Violence or any other anti-gun group, whatever that means. I'm actually quite a fan of guns and the Second Amendment. It's that Idaho DNA. Where I'm from, gun control means use both hands. Even though I do think we do a poor job of keeping them out of the hands of the violent and mentally ill, and there's really something wrong with our culture when our rate of gun homicides to the international rate is over 15 to 1. But what's the truth? And what led me to this 90% quote? Well, first of all, there was a February story in the New York Times that was entitled U.S.'s Arms Bazaar for Mexican Cartels, where I first picked up on the theme. But nowhere in that story did it actually get to the 90% quote. That seems to have come up in March. In the mid-March, we get this joint statement to Congress from members of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and the DEA, and this is where I believe the 90% has come from. "Because firearms are not readily available in Mexico, drug traffickers have aggressively turned to the U.S. as their primary source. Firearms are routinely being transported from the U.S. into Mexico in violation of both U.S. and Mexican law. In fact, according to ATF's National Tracing Center, 90% of the weapons that could be traced were determined to have originated from various sources within the U.S. So that figure's pretty damning, but notice the caveat, that could be traced. Not all weapons are traceable. And not all weapons were turned into the tracing center. This little detail got left out as the whole 90% figure made the rounds. In fact, the hearing with the ATF and the DEA wasn't even gaveled closed before Senators Dick Durbin and Dianne Feinstein were ignoring that little detail. So this got amplified later on in March. Secretary of State Clinton was on the CBS Early Show, and she says the 90% figure. President Obama says it in mid-April as he's in a press conference with the Mexican president. Various news media repeated it. Chicago Tribune, New York Times, Christian Science Monitor, CNN, NBC, and Reuters even toward the end of May was printing this in an article they entitled "Mexico Cartels Go Bargain Gun Shopping in Houston." So the detail here that's important is that the guns that were submitted for tracing and could be traced needs to be considered in light of all the guns, traceable and untraceable, submitted or not, that are seized in Mexico's drug war. Now, Fox News decided to take a look at that, and they decided that the U.S. share of Mexican drug war guns was 17%, not 90%. "There's just one problem with the 90% statistic, and it's a big one. It's just not true. In fact, it's not even close. The fact is, only 17% of guns found at Mexican crime scenes have been traced to the U.S. In 2007-2008, according to ATF Special Agent William Newell, Mexico submitted 11,000 guns to the ATF for tracing. Close to 6,000 were successfully traced, and of those, 90%... 5,114 to be exact, according to testimony in Congress by William Hoover, were found to have come from the U.S. But in those same 2 years, according to the Mexican government, 29,000 guns were recovered at crime scenes. In other words, 68% of the guns that were recovered were never submitted for tracing. And when you weed out the roughly 6,000 guns that could not be traced from the remaining 32%, it means 83% of the guns found at crime scenes in Mexico could not be traced to the U.S. Fox goes on to explain how guns come from illicit sources like China, Russian gangs, South American drug cartels, and the Mexican army itself when its deserters took their firearms with them. However, Fox is playing a little fast and loose with the details as well, and I'm shocked. Do you hear? Shocked. In the New Old Testament Fox cited, he mentions 11,055 guns submitted in those two fiscal years of 2007 through 2008. We can report that our efforts are paying off. Mexico has increased the number of firearms it has submitted for tracing from 3,312 in fiscal year 2007 to 7,743 in fiscal year 2008. In fact, 90% of the firearms recovered in Mexico, and which are then successfully traced, were determined to have originated from various sources within the continental U.S. Where Fox goes wrong is saying that close to 6,000 were successfully traced. This is a reference to the guns that could be directly traced to a specific U.S. state. When contacted by factcheck.org, ATF reiterated that over 90% of the guns that were turned in for tracing could be traced back to the United States. So what we have here is this. Mexican authorities seized 29,000 guns in the drug war. 11,000 of those guns are turned into ATF. Over 10,000 come from the U.S. It works out to 93.6% of the Mexican drug war guns turned into the ATF came from the USA. Now, that leaves roughly 18,000 guns that are not turned in to the ATF. You might assume that Mexico only turns in obviously American guns to the ATF for tracing, but this has not been confirmed. How many of the remaining 18,000 guns came from the U.S. is not known, but I'm willing to bet it is a non-zero number. It's a slippery stat since we don't really know exactly how many guns the Mexican seize, we don't know what guns the Mexican cartels still hold and where they came from, and we don't know if the guns seized are an accurate representative sample of all Mexican drug war guns. What we do know is that when our officials examine a sample of 38% of all seized guns, 93.6% of them came from America. We do know that, at the very least, 35.7% of all guns seized in the Mexican drug war are from the U.S., with an unknown number of the remaining 62% of the unexamined guns coming from the U.S. If even one out of four of the unexamined guns comes from the U.S., a fair estimate, I think, then over half of all Mexican drug war guns come from the U.S. No matter how you slice it, the Mexican drug cartels are getting a large portion of their guns, at least one out of three, and maybe half, from the United States. I don't present that as pro-gun or anti-gun. I present it to rebut the politicians and media's 90% claim and Fox's and the NRA's 17% claim. Proposal to ban medical marijuana patients from workplace dies in divided Oregon House. From the Daily Journal of Commerce. The sponsor of a bill to allow Oregon employers to ban medical marijuana from the workplace said on Monday he'll keep pressing the issue after the bill died in committee, failing by one vote. Quote, every session I come back as an employer, I'll be bringing it back, end quote, said Representative Bruce Hanna, Republican of Roseburg, owner of Automatic Vending Service. The full House of Representatives voted last week on a motion to pull House Bill 3052 from the Committee on Business and Labor, where it had languished since a public hearing in March. The committee's chair, Representative Mike Schaffler, Democrat of Happy Valley, co-sponsored the bill with Hanna, but could not secure the votes to get it out of committee. The House voted 29-29 on the motion, which would have brought the bill to the House floor for a vote, bypassing the committee process. All 29 no votes were cast by Democrats. In 2007, the same bill was introduced but died in committee. The bill would allow employers to prohibit workers from using marijuana during working hours or arriving at work under the influence. Hanna said, quote, I just want an opportunity to say we can prohibit our employees from consuming or possessing marijuana during work hours, end quote. No. you want to prohibit people who consume or possess marijuana from becoming or being your employee. Oregon's Medical Marijuana Act already says nothing in the act shall be construed to require an employer to accommodate the medical use of marijuana in any workplace. What Representatives Hanna and Schaffler don't like about the law is that medical marijuana causes failures on pre-employment and random pee tests, and they want to be able to fire anyone they detect as having non-impairing carboxy-THC marijuana metabolites in their system. What they don't like is that medical marijuana patients are not medicating in the workplace, nor are they impaired at the workplace. But if businesses can't fire patients for failing a test for non-impairing metabolites, they feel like they're accommodating the medical use of marijuana. Currently, there is no protection for patients' right to work in Oregon statute or case law, but these business leaders fear that when one of them does fire an unimpaired medical marijuana patient, the patient will sue and the courts will determine they weren't impaired and the firing was unlawful and the business will be on the hook for damages. They also fear if they can't discriminate against medical marijuana patients, someday one will be impaired on the job and hurt someone and the business will be on the hook for damages. Even though such an occurrence has not happened in 10 years of medical marijuana with over 25,000 patients, and today's OSHA stats on workplace safety are the lowest ever recorded. Basically, business wants to enshrine job discrimination against 25,000 citizens into Oregon law because they're afraid of lawsuits. The simple thing to do would be to grant patients a waiver from workplace pee tests that turn up positive for non-impairing carboxy-THC. But that's problematic because businesses still want to fire and not hire the 19 out of 20 Oregon pot smokers who use marijuana for non-medical purposes. How do you convince Peter Potsmoker that the joint he smoked at a concert on the weekend makes him an unacceptable danger at the workplace, when you've just given a waiver to Granny Glaucoma or Emily Epilepsy who smoke a joint every night before going to bed? Allowing medical marijuana patients a pass on pee tests make the pee tests even more indefensible and illogical than they already are.
Dear Mr. President, last November you were elected on a platform of change. You promised the country reform on the political system. Well, let me tell you what Normal.org and many other Americans want changed. Marijuana laws. It was estimated that America made its 20 millionth arrest for marijuana possession this year. You want a real economic problem? How about the amount of money being spent on simple possession arrests? Incarcerating people costs taxpayers around $23,000 per year, and Normal estimates that up to $10 billion a year are spent on enforcement for mostly nonviolent offenders. Now let's imagine what would happen if marijuana was legal. Not only would we save billions each year on enforcement, but imagine the economic boost. You would produce jobs growing, selling, and tax dollars coming in from the regulation of marijuana. I'm not saying let people loose to sell on the streets. Put government regulation into tax and control at sales like alcohol. Street dealers are the problem, not a guy with a gram in his pocket. Put in harsh punishments for people who drive under the influence, and stop punishing people who enjoy marijuana safely in their home. Mr. President, if you really want change, legalize marijuana.
Tuesday is our look at your government at work here at the Audio Stash. While the inevitable re-legalization of cannabis hemp will have to happen at the federal level, the steps leading to that destination take place at the state and municipal levels. We focus in on the initiatives, bills, and amendments regarding cannabis across all 50 states and what activists like you are doing to enact a positive reform to our cruel and outdated marijuana laws.
Body dies the legal price, the birds they sing, the creatures learn. It's an honest day's work, yeah, 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 yeah. It's an honest day's work.
If you're working hard to make an impact in your city and state, please email us at stash@normal.org. And let's share your local efforts with the worldwide cannabis community. Together, we can affect our government at work.
The afternoon pollution rises high into the sky. How can we still deny the truth?
All right, for our Government at Work segment today, we're going to be taking a look back at the East Coast of America. Specifically, we're going to head all the way out to New Jersey, and we're joined now by two activists that are very busy in the state. We've spoken before to Fred DeMaria, who's the executive director of Normal New Jersey. He's on the phone with us. And joining us for the first time is Evan Nissen, who's working on an initiative in East Brunswick. So, gentlemen, welcome to the Daily Audio Stash.
Hi, Brad. Thanks for having us.
Oh, glad to have you here. So, Evan, tell us a little bit about East Brunswick. Where is that in New Jersey, and how many people? What size of city are we talking about?
Well, East Brunswick is dead in the middle of New Jersey, smack in the center. We have about 50,000 people in the town, so a little bit smaller than Trenton, to give people a perspective.
Okay. And so the initiative that you're trying to get on the ballot, what exactly would it do?
Well, it would do three things. It would make adult personal marijuana offenses the lowest law enforcement priority. It would require the township to report, estimate how much time and money they spend on law enforcement for adult marijuana use and for punishment for adult marijuana use. And it would require an arresting police officer to explain why the arrest occurred despite its low priority.
Oh, wow.
To give it some teeth.
Yeah, that's...
We designed the ordinance to give it some teeth, because that's mainly the problem with a lot of low-priority ordinances or statutes, is that it's almost unenforceable the way that most of them are written. What we've done is we've actually had them put in exactly what they're thinking when they're making these arrests. And there's a reporting requirement. It does two things. It gives us perspective, and it also opens up that information to an Open Records Act. That's Open Records Search, I'm sorry.
Okay, so it kind of puts this paperwork in their way, and if there's one thing we know police don't like, it's a whole lot of extra paperwork.
We know that. We did try actually to limit it, the reporting requirements, to not make it so arduous for the police officers, because we know they have a job to do too.
Yeah, we gave them 30 days. Some ordinances just give them 10 days to fill out this stuff. We gave them a full month.
We gave them a full month to do what they had to do, and we gave them, I think, a yearly reporting requirement to compile data.
Oh, okay. Now, Evan, what's the feel you get from people on the street there in East Brunswick? I mean, I don't know the demographics very well, but is it a college town? I mean, how do the people feel about this issue?
Well, we're right next to Rutgers, which is a college town.
Okay.
But we're pretty much the opposite. We're a family-oriented town, so I wasn't really sure how the public would react to it. And it's interesting because I started getting signatures, you know, right before the media just turned pro-legalization. I started briefly before that, and I got a good amount of signatures, but not nearly the reaction I get anymore, you know. I'll get, for maybe one or two people that are really against it and pissed off about it, I'll get four or five that are really for it and want to actually help out. So the media, I mean, I noticed a very obvious, very obvious difference in the change because of the media.
Now, Fred, looking across the entire state of New Jersey, is this something that is going to be something that goes over well in East Brunswick, but you might have trouble in other cities, or is this a strategy you want to pursue throughout the state?
There's a couple of things to note. First of all, only some of the towns we can do this in New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
Any of the towns founded pursuant to the Faulkner Act, and I believe there's about 10% of the New Jersey municipalities that are founded pursuant to that act. Any of those towns we're able to do this in. And so we're using this town, East Brunswick, as sort of a barometer to gauge the reception and to work out any kinks in the process. And we plan to take it to every town we can.
All right.
Interest right now from around, I don't know, I'd say I got interest from five or six towns, and right now I narrowed it down to two or three towns that we're thinking about going to next.
Excellent. Now, Evan, if people want to get involved with this and help support you guys in any way, or if they just want to find out more information, do you have a website that people could look up?
We're actually currently building a website right now. We have a blog, but for more information, I would ask that people email me, especially if you want a petition. Right now we need a lot of petitioners. My email address is enison1@ithaca.edu.
And also you could go to normalnewjersey.org to find more information.
Yeah.
All right. So enison1@ithaca.edu. We'll put a link up to that up on the Stash blog, as well as the link to Normal New Jersey. Now, Fred, going back to just the whole state here for a moment, I know that New Jersey has been fighting for a medical marijuana bill. Do you have any updates on that progress?
Yes, Russ. Actually, as you may have heard, the Assembly Subcommittee just voted in favor of the bill. So that means that it will be going to a full Assembly vote on the bill. However, unfortunately, what the Assembly did was they added what they call substitutions to the bill, which in reality means they added new regulations and took out some of the good stuff that we thought made the last bill, the one that voted, the Senate already voted on, effective. They took out the chronic pain catch-all provision, which eliminates probably between 40% and 45% of medical marijuana patients from immediately receiving the medical marijuana. There was some reasoning espoused by the head of the Assembly Subcommittee, Assemblyman Conaway, that really didn't make much sense. His goal was to not treat symptoms, but to treat diseases, and since pain is just a symptom, they eliminated that catch-all. It's unfortunate, and I think it in many ways makes this bill impotent. But otherwise, they also eliminated the ability of a patient to grow their own marijuana, instead opting to insist that anyone who gets medical marijuana get that medicine through an alternative treatment center, which the state regulates, adds another middleman to the process, of course, and adds costs for a lot of people. They mandated that patients who receive their medical marijuana cards be reevaluated every 3 months by a physician. They also are requiring that the only doctors that are able to authorize someone to get a medical marijuana card in New Jersey be the doctor who that patient regularly sees in an effort to prevent doctor hopping or shopping. Of course, this bill, the way they voted on, is different than the Senate bill. So now there's going to have to be some resolution between the Assembly and the Senate regarding these so-called substitutions. If the Assembly bill stands the way it is right now, it is an ineffective bill. So we actually have to do a lot of work in rectifying the changes that they made.
So when this
40% of the patients that it won't cover right now, right?
Depending on the estimates, between 40% and 45%, and that's if you use statistics from California and Oregon.
Yeah. Now, looking at this with the Assembly version having to come back to the Senate and to be resolved with the senators there, do they have to accept everything the Assembly put into it, or can they compromise?
They do not have to accept everything the Assembly put in it. However, they will have to at some point agree on something that is exactly the same before it can become law. So while they don't have to agree, it could stalemate the process.
I see. One other topic here that often gets brought up in marijuana law reform is the idea of decriminalization. Is there any look at pursuing that measure in New Jersey sometime soon?
Well, of course, that's our long-term goal at Normal, New Jersey, is for outright decriminalization, not just for medicinal purposes, but we believe, of course, that marijuana should be allowed recreationally as well, just like alcohol and nicotine are. Right now, we are really focused on the medicinal aspect, and that's where most of the media attention is.
Okay.
If we're successful, then we will move forward from there.
All right. Evan, I just wanted to ask you a couple questions too. On a personal level, is this something new to you, getting involved with marijuana law activism? And if there's someone out there listening who's new to this, what kind of advice would you give them?
Well, I actually just wanted to start an initiative because I'm interested in law and government. And then I decided to pick marijuana law reform. I contacted my township. They wouldn't give me legal advice when I told them what it was for. So I called Keith at National, and he directed me to Fred. And since then, I've been doing research. I got more involved, started a Students for Responsible Drug Policy, which I would like to incorporate with the New York chapter of Normal as well. The more research you do, the more outrageous it is, really. And anyone who wants to get involved, I'd say it's extremely easy to get involved. You know, there's initiatives. You could help initiatives, start an initiative, start a blog. I mean, there's so many things. Just getting the word out there would really help.
Evan has accomplished quite a lot by himself, and we need more people like him.
Right on. Well, you can get involved with your local Normal. Just send me an email at chapters@normal.org, and I'll put you in touch with people like Fred and people all over the country who are involved with this. And if there's nobody near you, we'll make you the person. We'll get you started and give you all the information you need. That's what we're all about here. None of us can re-legalize marijuana by ourselves, but together it's inevitable. Absolutely. Also want to remind folks of the addresses. If you want to get a hold of Evan, the email address is ENISON1@ithaca.edu, and Normal, New Jersey is at normlnj.org. Fred, before we go, anything else you'd want to wrap up with?
I just want everybody listening to know our upcoming annual meeting is on the 27th of June, and for more details, see our website.
All right. Well, Fred DeMaria and Evan Nesson, thank you so much for joining us here on the Daily Audio Stash.
Thanks, Brad.
Hello, this is Webb Hubble. Life insurance is now available for responsible marijuana smokers. For years, responsible marijuana smokers have not been able to access affordable life insurance products. Normal uniquely supports cannabis consumers. Two carriers have already agreed to offer all of their traditional life insurance products at all levels without excluding individuals who smoke marijuana responsibly. Help Normal and help yourself. If you've been declined for life insurance, are paying above market premiums, or simply want to know what now may be available in the way of insurance for marijuana smokers, contact me at info@mclaughlinonline.com or simply call me at 202-293-5566.
The battle to end adult marijuana prohibition can sometimes seem endlessly frustrating and impossible to overcome. One way we bond as a community and draw strength to continue is by rejuvenating our spirit through art and music. The Marijuana Music Awards exist to recognize those sonic artists in all genres of music who feature a ganja-friendly message to motivate and inspire all the cannabis community. Our Daily Toker Tunes, brought to you by MarijuanaMusicAwards.com, feature the finest in blues, rock, jazz, hip-hop, rap, reggae, country, bluegrass, and dance music to enhance that 420 feeling and refresh all you stashers for another day on the front lines of the drug war. Enjoy this cut from MarijuanaMusicAwards.com and visit our blog at stash.normal.org to learn how you can vote for your favorites and enter your Toker Tunes in the 2009 Marijuana Music Awards. My dear Tam from Marijuana Music Awards is still working on the American version of the awards, so while she's busy, I get to bring you more music from my personal collection. Los Marihuanos from Las Vegas are the first weed-friendly hip-hoppers I've ever had the pleasure to work with. They helped inaugurate our Portland Hempstock Festival, always the weekend after Labor Day, come join us, and appeared at three of our million marijuana marches in Portland, Oregon. Pony Boy leads the group with FCM Click as the backing rappers. Pony's been featured in the movie Get Pony Boy and has rapped and produced on many albums, including the Los Marihuanos records. He is also a diehard activist and can be found at nearly every top-level marijuana party on the West Coast, including private parties at good friend Eddie Lepp's Medicinal Gardens. Flame On is a tune from their 2006 Hempfest release, Something to Smoke To. I particularly like the line about the flame that killed John Wayne. And registered stashers, you can get an MP3 download of this tune. It's Los Marihuanos with Flame On.
Oh, shit, fired up. Flame on, flame on if you can. You're looking for the dope weed, pony boy's a man. Flame on, flame on if you can. You're looking for the dope weed. Fire it up. Flame on, flame on if you can. You're looking for the dope weed, pony boy's a man. Flame on, flame on if you can. You're looking for the dope weed. Flame on, flame on, hit the lighter. If you burn blood, then you cruise to a rider. If the blood's loose, then you gotta roll tighter. Realize on rocks to the freedom fighter. Shine, brothers in indie. Fire up a joint even though if it's windy. Don't even care, smoke anywhere. When I'm at up, showing up to the share. I got the flame that killed John Wayne. Burn my brain, went through the pain. Stole the nips, stole the dime. Stole the bunk, stole the pine. You know how I do, I don't wanna dance. 420 home, just time to flame on. Flame on, flame on if you can. You're looking for the dope weed, pony boy's a man. Flame on, flame on if you can. You're looking for the dope weed. Arriba, arriba, I told the Shiva. Copping LP from Mexico, get Viva.
drinking right here, drinking a 40 ounce of beer, wondering if you're far or you're near. Well, I don't know you're gonna show, but my homie, I got to know. Nevertheless, I say, you got me smoking, choking, bonafide loking, family bone, have my ass choking, smoke filled boom, turn up a boom. One more hit, gonna fly to the moon. Apollo, leave your head hollow, like the Pied Piper chief. No más, cabrón, dale gas. Fúmate uno y busca la paz. Ponte tranquilo, arriba el estilo. Si tienes otra bolsa, amiga, yo te cuido. Flame on, flame on if you can. You're looking for the dope weed, only what you man. Flame on, flame on if you can. You're looking for the dope weed. Fire it up. Flame on, flame on if you can. You're looking for the dope weed, only what you man. Flame on, flame on if you can. You're looking for the dope weed.
I'm Alan St. Pierre, Executive Director of Normal. Have you heard about the new super pot that's supposedly 20 times more potent than your father's Woodstock weed? Don't believe the hype. Marijuana's THC potency has always varied, even in the 60s and 70s. And the drug czar's numbers are full of, well, exaggerations. While no intoxicant is harmless, cannabis is non-toxic and far safer than alcohol. No matter how much you smoke, of whatever potency, you cannot die of a marijuana overdose. Potency is irrelevant anyway. More potent pot just means you smoke less of it, meaning less harmful smoke in your lungs. This is a prime example of harm reduction in action. Besides, the government already allows the prescription of THC pills. Its commercial brand name is Marinol, and it's 100% potent. Meanwhile, the federal government won't allow dying people to use natural marijuana, no matter what the potency. Does this make sense to you? Learn the facts about pot. Visit norml.org today.
This is the California Marijuana Report for the week of June 15th, 2009. I'm Eric Brenner. This week, the city of Vacaville imposes a 45-day moratorium on cannabis dispensaries. A San Diego man who ran a collective is facing four marijuana-related felony charges, a marijuana memory with acid folk rocker Buzzy Linhart, as he recalls smoking hashish with Jimi Hendrix. And we're back in L.A. for our California Marijuana Music segment, a visit with the Brian Jonestown Massacre, only on the California Marijuana Report. Officials in the city of Vacaville recently enacted a 45-day moratorium on marijuana dispensaries. The San Francisco Chronicle reported on May 26 that the council was considering the moratorium because of the, quote, health, safety, and welfare of the community. Mark Monasfero, the PIO for the city of Vacaville, spoke to the California Marijuana Report regarding the health, safety, and welfare statement and the temporary ban on pot collectives.
We've been approached by at least two or three different individuals who would like to open medical marijuana dispensaries in the city. They were told that our zoning does not allow that type of use anywhere in the city. One individual threatened to open a dispensary with or without permits. Our staff talked to our city attorney's office. They discussed the case of going on in Anaheim, qualified patients versus Anaheim, and where that is in the process in the courts, and decided that until some decision is reached in that case, that we should have something in place just as an added precaution, an added go above and beyond what our zoning already states, and have that in place for the time being. Our staff is going to wait and see what happens with the outcome of the case, the Anaheim case, and then either, depending on what that outcome is, craft some code to address medical marijuana dispensaries. The city of Anaheim passed an ordinance that outlawed medical marijuana dispensaries, and they were challenged in court by an organization called Qualified Patients Association. And that is, apparently the city won in the first round, and Qualified Patients has appealed this to an appeals board or a higher court, and that's currently winding its way through the court system right now. So from what I understand, there's a decision is going to be reached within a few months.
Mark, would you also tell me again, this was the Vacaville Reporter that wrote this statement about promoting the health, safety, and welfare, that whole thing. Is that true?
I think what the Chronicle did, they rewrote her story, which wrote off of the staff report. So you have to look at the staff report to really, and I hate to use this word, to really understand the context of that comment. So it made it sound like we are doing this because we're afraid of medical marijuana dispensaries, and that's not the case at all. It's part of the overall mission of the city is to protect the health, safety, and welfare of all our residents. You take that context any way you like, other than that's necessarily accurate.
Mark Mazzavero from Vacaville, the city of Vacaville, the public information officer. Thanks for joining us today on the California Marijuana Report.
You're welcome. My pleasure.
San Diego man who ran a cannabis collective is now fighting to keep his freedom. Eugene Davinovich was set up by a fake patient who turned out to be Detective Peterson of the San Diego Police Department. The 28-year-old Davinovich sold a quarter ounce of marijuana to Peterson, all caught on videotape. Then in November, his home was raided, where authorities found 2 ounces of marijuana. Davinovich spoke to the California Marijuana Report about his new legal fight.
His patient called, asked to join the collective. We verified all the information that he provided, including his date of birth, his first and last name, his doctor, the date that he saw his doctor last, duration of his recommendation, and after obtaining all of that information, actually called the doctor and spoke with him, confirming that, in fact, he was a patient and was eligible to join a collective. After that, we called him back and spoke with him. He requested that medicine be delivered to his house because he could not cultivate. So in November, I think that was the 13th, as the videotape shows, I show up at his house, deliver the medication that he requested. Because it was the first time that I saw him after the conversation, I needed to verify that all the information was correct, and that was in fact the person that had joined the collective over the phone. So to show his driver's license, the California driver's license, and his original recommendation from his physician, which he did, and I verified it did match everything that Jamie Conlon, that was his name, that Jamie had provided to us. And so I proceeded to go into the house and provide him with the medication that he had requested. Several months later, in February, my house is raided. Maybe 9 or 10 people that showed up that morning as I was getting ready for work and came into the house, searched everything, arrested me, hauled me off to jail, and now I'm facing 4 felony charges.
How did this guy, who, by the way, had long hair,
lied about his symptoms, lied about his identity and everything else, and was able to obtain a valid recommendation for medical marijuana.
Eugene Davinovich makes another appearance in San Diego Superior Court on July 13th. California cult hero Buzzy Linhart. Linhart is no stranger to the California Marijuana Report. This acid folk rocker released several critically acclaimed psychedelic folk albums in the late 60s and early 70s. He was also a friend of Jimi Hendrix and played vibes on the Hendrix classic Drifting. Buzzy Linhart, thanks for joining us today on the California Marijuana Report. Let me ask you this. Did you ever light up with Jimi?
Absolutely. Lit a pipe of red Lebanese hash and personally handed to him 10-15 times, you know, in one sitting. And one night Jimi Hendrix came over to our rehearsal loft, that's the Seventh Sons, and it was before he went to London. Remember, he was a hidden giant in the United States and had no firm record deal of his own yet. Still very young, exactly the same age as I was, so I really related to him, and when I think back, I relate to the fact that Jimi and I were the same age.
Did he like to smoke marijuana?
He loved marijuana. I remember one night seeing Jimi found it so important what he would say to people, since everybody respected him so highly, and of course the press was after him to say obnoxious things and try to reveal that. He decided, like Bob Dylan, to not speak for days on end to anyone except his close associates. So during one period of time when Jimi didn't speak to anybody but Eddie Kramer and Buddy Miles, for a 3.5 month period that I recall, I was standing in line to see a grass dealer in the Chelsea Hotel, famous hotel we know of, Vicious and Devin Wilson, known as Dolly Dagger, Jimmy's famous girlfriend, both died there. Everybody stayed there when it came to town, Clapton, everybody. We were standing in line in the dealer's apartment, waiting quietly. The door opened. It was Buddy and Jimi, and Buddy was a giant persona. Of course, everybody just moved aside. There was no Red Sea in the way. We split. Buddy rocked right up to the desk. It was like a scene from a movie. And he said, "Jimi wants a kilo of your best smoke." And they bought it, and they turned to leave. I was leaning against the wall by the door watching this. As they passed me, Jimi looked at me, and he said, "I'll see you tomorrow."
Well, I had a glass of wine on the plane. It's my religion and my family's religion that we try to have a mind-blowing God experience once a week.
When do you have a general light? What's that?
It's all in the hands of the astrological forces.
What day this week did you have this mind-blowing experience?
Well, I'm having it right now.
How do you feel about marijuana? Now.
I think it's one of God's greatest gifts to mankind.
Can we go home?
Sure.
All right, let's go home.
Now for some California marijuana music. This week we check in with the Brian Jonestown Massacre. Formed in San Francisco's Haight-Ashbury district in the early 90s, these very talented, totally original neo-psychedelic rockers have a worldwide following. They now reside in Los Angeles. From their CD and This Is Our Music, When Jokers Attack, the Brian Jonestown Massacre are California rock legends only on the California Marijuana Report. We'll be right back. This has been the California Marijuana Report for the week of June 15th, 2009. Special thanks to the Brian Jonestown Massacre, Quicksilver Messenger Service, Harvey Mandel, Buzzy Lynn Hart, Dr. Timothy Leary, Jimi Hendrix, and of course Normal, the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. Please join our group on Facebook. Email CaliforniaMarijuanaReport@yahoo.com. I'm Eric Brenner for the California Marijuana Report.
Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.norml.org, and you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent. We leave you today with yet another reminder to catch the show Anderson Cooper 360 on CNN all this week, 7 p.m. Pacific, 10 p.m. Eastern Time, for his segment, America's High, the case for and against pot. And again, Wednesday, Normal board member and executive director of Oregon Normal, Madeline Martinez, will be featured on the Anderson Cooper 360 show, as well as shots from our cardholders meeting, where marijuana plants and medicine are given away for free to registered cardholders in the Oregon Medical Marijuana Program. You might even get a chance to see me scurrying about behind the scenes a little bit in some of the B-roll. It's an exciting time to be a part of marijuana law reform, and if you want to get involved, send me an email at stash@normal.org. I'll find a Normal chapter near you or help you start one. And until next time, take care of each other, tokers.